This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow is producing, and we start with Joshua Zeitz, a contributing writer at Politico and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, of the New York Times bestseller Lincoln's Boys, and three other works of history. He's written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and The New Republic, among many other publications, and was a commentator in Ken Burns' documentary Prohibition. Joshua Zeitz has written a profound book about the 16th American president, Abe Lincoln. He, of course, was regarded by many as the greatest of American presidents, and Abe Lincoln, who died in 1865, left quite a legacy, and one of them that Joshua Zeitz is focusing on in Lincoln's God is about his faith, and the subtitle is How Faith Transformed a President and a Nation. And good morning to you, Joshua.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation to join you.
It is a pleasure. This is a part of Lincoln's background that has not been covered as earnestly as other parts of his life. And why has it taken so long to, if you will, expose him as an evangelical Christian?
Well, I think one thing I would say is that the book makes the case that that Lincoln undergoes a spiritual transformation from a sort of non-believer to believer during the war. But what's fascinating about him is that while he becomes really astute at channeling the language and the activism of the Christian churches, which in this period were predominantly Protestant and evangelical, and which were enormously influential in his efforts to sustain support for the war and later for the Republican Party, his faith is really iconoclastic. He doesn't really become an evangelical in the same way as the majority of his country people. His faith during the war is much more subtle. He comes to believe in a fairly distant and unknowable God, and he's not conventionally, his wife later said after his death, that he was never a technical Christian, and he's certainly not a Trinitarian in any recognizable way. But I think when I said provocatively, or tried to be a little provocative, that he's arguably the first evangelical president, that's in the sense, the same way that Reagan was an evangelical president. He wasn't necessarily an evangelical Christian himself, but both presidents knew how to channel the energy and enthusiasm of the churches for political ends. And certainly Lincoln proved the first president and arguably the most astute one at that, in terms of his understanding of the political power of the evangelical movement, but also the ways in which evangelical Protestantism was the lingua franca of his day. And he understood that it was very helpful as a means of communicating to American Northerners, that is, what the war was about, what it meant, and what their role in it might be.
You note that he, among other things, was a masterful politician and, like Reagan, tapped into the nation's fervor for belief and for Christianity, a majority Christian nation at that time, and maybe even at this time, although much smaller majority. But more than any president before him or any president after, until George W. Bush, Lincoln harnessed popular religious enthusiasm to build a broad-based support for his party and a cause. And was the religious aspect essential to him leading the nation through the Civil War?
That's right. I mean, I think what's fascinating about this story in my mind is that, you know, the nation in the decades up to the Civil War underwent a profound religious revival. It's known as the Second Great Awakening. And you saw the emergence of new, or at least the growth of newer denominations like the Baptists, Methodists, newer to the United States anyway, Disciples of Christ. And by the eve of the war, the churches were arguably the most important and largest non-governmental building block of civil society in the entire country. On the eve of the war, there were just as many Methodist ministers in the country as there were post office postal workers, which sounds like a weird statistic, but remember at the time the U.S. Postal Service was the largest branch of the U.S. government and the one with which most Americans had direct contact. And so Lincoln understands the power of the churches, and he understands the grip that evangelical Protestantism had on his country people. So even as his personal faith evolves, he proves very astute at working with and engaging the ministers and the lay leaders of the churches on behalf of emancipation and on behalf of the war effort. He becomes really mm-hmm. astute as well at weaving religious themes and the language of the King James Bible into his speeches and public papers, sometimes in subtle ways, as in the Gettysburg Address, sometimes in not so subtle ways, as in the second inaugural address in 1865. And he does so in a way that no president had done before, and that certainly would have been completely unrecognizable to anybody who knew Lincoln before 1861.
The guest is Joshua Zeitz. His book is Lincoln's God, How Faith Transformed a President and a Nation, fresh out from Penguin Random House. And Joshua Zeitz, a listener, Hal in Monroe, notes that it may not be that big of a leap for a Catholic to become a Methodist or an Episcopalian, but it is a big leap for a non-believer to become a believer. What was the catalyst, if there was one, for Lincoln to have this conversion?
I think that's a really important observation. And for him, I think it was a few things. And first and foremost, and the easiest to explain, was the death of his son, Willie, in early 1862 at the age of 10 from typhoid. So for the Lincolns, this confronted them with the same awful loss and intimate loss of life in their household that about tens of hundreds of thousands of other families were experiencing during the war because of the war. They didn't lose a son in the war, but they lost a son to a disease at the same time that Lincoln himself is presiding over this carnival of deaths that would ultimately cost 750,000 lives. And so for Lincoln, there is the personal grief owing from Willie's death, coupled with the realization that he is responsible for all of this destruction and for the deaths of so many young men in this war. And he's grasping at some form of understanding as to why this responsibility that was weighing so heavily on him. And at the same time, he's also grasping for a way to convey to the country why this war was important, what it meant, what the larger mm-hmm. import of it was. And, you know, in so doing, he comes to a genuinely felt faith, albeit one that is somewhat distinct from that of his fellow country people, but he comes to believe that he was divinely ordained to be an instrument of God in the pursuit of both emancipation and the war's, you know, the war's conduct. And that's, you know, that heady sense of responsibility, I think, leads him, like many other people in the country, to grasp for some sort of faith-based explanation.
There's the old axiom that there are no atheists in foxholes, and if ever a president were in a foxhole, it was Abe Lincoln. And he, of course, gave his life for his country at the age of 56, which at that time was considered to be an old man. And he had to know that he was in particular personal jeopardy by virtue of the stands he was taking. So at that level... when he was facing all these pressures, would it be natural to seek out some power beyond this earth?
I think that might be right. We tend to look at the second inaugural address, which he gave just weeks before his assassination, and which is just suffused with religious symbolism and import. We tend to look at it and think, well, this is a man who clearly knew that his own end was nearing, and that's sort of an anachronistic way to look back at it. I think though that it, you know, because he certainly didn't know that was going to be the end of his presidency. I think it's more the case that rather than think of his own fate or destiny, I think that faith for him was a way of sorting out precisely what he was supposed to do and why he was supposed to do it. And it's no mystery that he becomes more religious in a sort of still more abstract sort of way than most Christians, but he becomes more religious as emancipation becomes a war aim and goal. And as the war shifts from being a war to preserve the Union, which is a very secular theme, it's about the preservation of democracy, and it becomes a war to free enslaved people, then it takes on much more biblical import and meaning. It looks a lot more like the Old Testament. It looks a lot more like the prophets or the Exodus. And so for him, understanding who he is in this drama, I think as the war shifts to become an emancipation, a liberation war, then religion becomes, you know, fundamentally more important for him as a framework for understanding why him and what his what he was put here to do in that context.
We only have about 45 seconds to go, but a listener asks another question, and you focus on some of the other major figures of the time, like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Frederick Douglass. Was this conversion unique to him, or were others having similar experiences?
I would say that this was a nation of that was predominantly Christian and predominantly evangelical Christian Protestant before the war. So Lincoln was always the iconoclast. The fact that he was a non-believer put him out of step with the rest of the country in the 1840s and 50s. And so for him, it's a sort of singular movement. But I would also, you know, add that the war itself also transforms people's sense of Christianity and the way that their theology operates. It changes the ways people think about death and the afterlife.
Joshua Zeitz, thank you so much. And the book is Lincoln's God, How Faith Transformed a President and a Nation. Back with Mark Ballard. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and she is ready, if you are so inclined, to give us a call at 877-217-5757. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org, as is our Thursday custom. We're hearing from Mark Ballard, who's at the nation's capital, man who not so long ago made a move from Baton Rouge, where he worked for more than a generation, and went to school at LSU, and he went east. Mark also has a advanced degree from Columbia University, one of the great institutions of higher learning, but he's in Washington, where the politics are much different than they are in Louisiana. To give you an example, in Washington, I believe in both 2016 and 2020, Donald Trump received fewer than 10% of the votes in Washington, D.C. As we know, he got right at almost 60%, 58% in Louisiana in the last election, and that included more than 80% of those in the majority race. White people voted for Trump in huge numbers, as black people voted for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. And we just had this fine writer, Joshua Zeitz, on, Mark. He's written a biography about Abe Lincoln. There have been a lot of them, and he takes a new look, and this one's about Lincoln's spirituality. But I was in Chicago last December and walked in the hotel where I was staying, and there were two oil paintings. One was of President Obama, and one was of President Lincoln. And I thought, Mark, I'm not in the Southeastern Conference anymore.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The politics up here are far different than they are down there, as far as, you know, who's in charge. I got a note from who my state representative would be in the General Assembly of Virginia, and just absolutely was talking about his pro-abortion stances, was talking about increased spending for public schools, was talking about support of recreational marijuana, and I'm thinking, boy, I am not in Louisiana anymore.
Well, you're at the Capitol, and I know that's a bustling place, but we do have some ambient sound. It sounds like somebody's talking over your shoulder, Mark, but we'll...
Let me turn that out and get out of here. That's the Chuck Schumer telling us what's going to happen today.
Chuck's in the office, huh?
Well, he's actually, the office is overlooking the Senate chamber. And we're expecting Daryl Papillon to get his final confirmation as a U.S. District Judge, but it hasn't been put on the calendar today. So well, that was why I was in there listening.
And I wholeheartedly endorse that. Fine man. And I'm sure he'll be a fine federal judge. And he also had the support of both U.S. senators in Louisiana. And, of course, we're talking about a Democratic president who nominated a guy who could have been blocked by Senator Kennedy or Senator Cassidy, but they are on board, and hats off to Senators Cassidy and Kennedy. But Mark, if you read your Advocate today on page 3A, John Kennedy, being the new John Kennedy, not the old one who used to work for Buddy Romer, has put his foot in his mouth, or maybe he didn't. Maybe he knew exactly what was going to happen, but he says our economy is $23 trillion. Mexico's economy is $1.3 trillion. Ours is 18 times bigger. We buy $400 billion every year from Mexico. Without the people of America, Mexico, figuratively speaking, would be eating cat food out of a can and living in a tent behind an outback. So there you go. And he goes on from there. He didn't stop there either, but that gives you an example of how John Kennedy is portraying our neighbors to the south, that they would be eating cat food out of a can if not for the U.S. And, of course, comparing the Mexico economy to the U.S. economy is like comparing the Louisiana economy to California's economy. And there's more than an 18-time gap between Louisiana and California, by the way. But John Kennedy, did he know what he was doing, or did he perhaps go too far, even for John Kennedy?
Well, there's a couple of things about that. Is that, you know, everybody kind of focused on those comments, but he also four times recommended that the U.S. Invade Mexico and take care of the cartels ourselves. Which is kind of out of the pale, but compared to talking about Mexicans eating cat food behind the outback, I guess, you know, was not nearly as exciting as that. The other thing that I found interesting is that he has so often made these kind of comments, outrageous comments, that when he did this, it didn't initially attract much attention. It wasn't until the Mexican government, through its foreign secretary and through its ambassador to the United States, said, you know, wait, this is racist and we deserve an apology, that anyone paid attention to it, because he made those comments a week ago. But we hear it so often from Senator Kennedy that it, you know, like it washes over with all of the other, you know, rather drink Drano comments.
Mm-hmm. So, 877-217-5757, John Neely Kennedy, junior U.S. Senator from Louisiana, who opted not to run for governor and quite possibly would have won this time and might have won last time if he had sought the governor's mansion, which used to be his major goal in life. But Kennedy will be 72 in November, so the only office that he would be a youngster in would be president of the United States. Any chance he might jump in 2024, Mark?
Well, I kind of doubt it, but, you know, only because we're talking about, I mean, I understand that Rick DeSantis is going to be Ron DeSantis, the guy from Florida,
yeah,
is going to be jumping in sometime next week is what the word is here. And I can't imagine that John Kennedy could, you know, put up a fight against Donald Trump and Governor DeSantis. And at 72, I'm not sure he would be a good vice presidential candidate for either one of those. I mean,
no, but so if Jeff Landry's successful in his pursuit to be governor of Louisiana, he would be an ideal vice presidential choice for Donald John Trump. And who knows? Might happen. He certainly has gotten the support of the former president, who I presume will be in Louisiana campaigning for General Landry.
I would suspect that to be the case.
Dominic in Grand Coteau. Dominic, you're on with Mark Ballard. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, man. I saw the news clip about Kennedy on Telemundo, and let me tell you, people need to watch that. It was vile. It was just below any sort of comments from a senator, our senator. You know, it was gross. It was embarrassing, and you know, it's just along the same ilk of Landry, who we hope will not be our next governor.
Well, I don't know that Landry makes these kinds of remarks, and I think we're going to have Jeff Landry on this show soon, but he. He also has an array of minority people in his campaign, including his campaign manager, Corey Dennis. John Kennedy, not so much. Of course, a U.S. senator would not have the staff that a potential governor would. But Kennedy, a few years ago, Mark, he fired his whole staff, and they were all conservatives, but he fired him for not being conservative enough. And I found that amusing because, as we know, he has had an evolution from really a leftist Ted Kennedy politician to he's right there with Marjorie Taylor Greene right now.
Oh, I would suggest even further than Marjorie Taylor Greene. Also, if you want to watch his comments, go to my story on the NOLA.com or theadvocate.com, because I have a link to to his 5 minutes in the Appropriations Committee. But it's hard not to be cynical about his switch in politics, such a dramatic switch in politics that kind of tracked Louisiana's own movement to the right. But, you know, I'm not going to question his views, but it is hard not to be cynical about it.
Well, as Tucker Carlson used to watch the people meter that these television programs now have, he would note that when the more extreme comments, he got the biggest responses. And John Kennedy knows when he makes statements like this that people start contributing money to his cause, and his cause is John Kennedy and other conservatives. And we'll talk with Mark and go to the phone lines after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're with Mark Ballard, who is following national and Louisiana politics, and two U.S. senators have been the focus of some of his writing of late. Bill Cassidy's involved in wonky-type things, and we'll talk a bit about those, while John Kennedy is out there, the firebrand from the right, saying that if it weren't for the United States, that Mexicans would be eating cat food out of a can. 877-217-5757, Kevin in North Baton Rouge. Kevin, you're on with Mark Ballard.
Yes, I don't understand how y'all can keep voting for these same people that don't do nothing, and how the media can keep doing this to their own people, your own family members. You can still just keep telling these lies and making it seem like these are some good people, and like the man from Lake Charles who made a fool out of himself, question the woman in the Congress behind this other stuff. I forgot his name.
All right. I think you're talking about Clay Higgins, Kevin, but I don't know that the media are complicit in this, Mark.
Yeah, I kind of have the same problem. And I hear this also from the right, but, you know, I don't actually have a vote in Congress. So, you know, all I do is kind of report what they do.
877-217-5757, Patrick in Innisfail States. Patrick, you're on with Mark Ballard.
Hey, you know, I wasn't impressed with Donald Trump's very last year in office. You know, he signed the CARES Act, and he did an eviction moratorium as well. And but I got to tell you, this CNN town hall meeting, he knocked it out of the ballpark, and I thought it was really well done. And it's making me support him now for president. And why are so many leftists, though, upset that CNN would at least host a town hall for the right? I mean, CNN's supposed to show both sides of the spectrum. I thought they're supposed to be like a neutral news source. And
all right. Well, Patrick, in that last remark, I agree that CNN did the right thing by hosting the town hall. I don't know that they should have accepted his ground rules with an audience full of his sycophants, but I don't blame him a bit for doing it, and I think MSNBC would have done it too. And back in 2016, MSNBC had Trump on night after night after night, but I don't know that Trump hit it out of the park. He may have hit it out of your park, but Mark Ballard, this is one of those red meat appearances by Donald Trump that plays well to the Republican base, and he is the Republican Party. But if it were in a general election, does it play well with others who are not as wildly right as he was that night?
I mean, yeah, I think that all that did was kind of point out to the people who support Trump why they supported Trump, and the people that don't support Trump, why they don't support Trump. And so I thought, you know, I thought, and I also agree with you that CNN was should be doing these things as neutral. And what the caller does is what is often happens with advocates on either side of it, was kind of conflate what actually happened. And what you had was you had some members of CNN exercising their own right of speech, saying that they didn't think that the CNN should have done it, you know, and there are others that, including, you know, a goodly number at CNN, because they did do it, there who would disagree with him. So, I mean, that to me seems like that's what this is all about.
Okay. Bill Bryan sent me a note here, and I'd heard about this, but here's an actual story about it, and I suspect Mark, being at the Capitol, has probably heard about this too. A news conference hosted by conservative legislators outside the U.S. Capitol yesterday was interrupted by a blue-shirted protester who buzzed around the podium with his phone out, peppering lawmakers like Paul Gosar of Arizona with questions as the protester filmed Gosar. A bald man in a dark suit approached him and calmly introduced himself. "Clay Higgins, I represent South Louisiana," the man says in the activist footage. "All I'm asking you to do is just peacefully stand by with your camera, and I promise you'll look at me. I'll come talk to you straight up and answer all your questions." Fair enough. But when the protester swooped back in, as Representative Lauren Boebert of Colorado was speaking, he barely had time to get out a question about whether her recent divorce was linked to a restaurant's tainted pork sliders before Higgins was back. In a video captured by both the protester, Jake Burdett, and other people at the scene, Higgins can be heard saying, no, you're out. He then puts his hands on Burdett and starts physically propelling him backwards, bundling him away from the event.
Okay, my first comment on that is that Bill Bryant reads the Daily Beast, and he doesn't read NOLA.com and TheAdvocate.com, where that story also appears.
Okay.
But you know, I know Bill, and I forgive him his fault. But yeah, this is going to be an issue throughout the day, because Higgins is seen on that videotape. Actually, you know, physically touching this particular advocate, who is a 25-year-old law student, and was there to protest the or to rattle the MAGA rally that was, or the MAGA news conference that was being held.
Okay, and Robin Dow, our producer, is asking me to allow her to play something, and I think it's related to this, and I'm not sure what it is, let's give it a listen.
"Aren't you a congressperson touching me? Get off me. You're hurting me. You're hurting me. Get off me. Get off me. Clay Higgins, get off me. What are you trying to do, Clay Higgins?
Stand by."
Well, he was the Crime Stopper guy, remember? So I guess he felt like he was intervening appropriately, but... But Clay Higgins, and I'd love to have him as a guest on this show, he's portrayed as a kook by many, but as I've stated before, when you look at his voting record and Garrett Graves' voting record, they're almost identical, Mark. Why are they portrayed in different ways?
Because of these kind of things that Clay Higgins does. Some of the things, he has a kind of Kennedy-esque type of method of using his 5 minutes to say outrageous things. So in many ways that he's not given the same kind of serious heft that congressmen like Garrett Graves and Mike Johnson, for instance, are given in the Republican conference.
877-217-5757, and Robin, I think, has found the aforementioned tape of John Kennedy opining about the great country of Mexico, and here is our junior senator, John Neely Kennedy, the man who was born in Centerville, Mississippi.
"If President Lopez Obrador invited the American military and or law enforcement personnel to come into Mexico and work with his, we could stop the cartels, couldn't we?"
"I believe, Senator, that we can stop the cartels."
"Okay. Have you made that suggestion to President Biden?"
"If I could, I believe that we can stop the cartels by..."
"Have you made that suggestion to President Biden?"
"Senator, I have been very vocal in the whole of government setting on the importance of fentanyl, and all of us using every single effort and authority that we
have." "Why hasn't President Biden done it? I mean, this is the way the American people, whose sons and daughters are dying, look at it. Our economy is $23 trillion. Mexico's economy is $1.3 trillion. Ours is 18 times bigger. We buy $400 billion every year from Mexico. Without the people of America, Mexico, figuratively speaking, would be eating cat food out of a can and living in a tent behind an outback.
I have a feeling he had prepared that remark before the appearance by the guest who was appearing before the panel.
Well, I can't say one way or the other. One thing that did happen was that he had a legislation that he wanted to increase the time that was served by people possessing fentanyl, and it got sidetracked in the Senate the day before. And he also wrote a kind of a scathing op-ed that appeared in many Louisiana papers on the morning before he made this. So this was obviously on his mind.
Yeah, he calls this a problem, a cartel schemes hatched in Mexico and fueled by Chinese fentanyl makers. So he kind of hits all the bases. Randy and Zachary. Randy, good morning. You're on with Mark Ballard. Hi, Randy.
Getting back to the discussing of Abraham Lincoln. To this day, Abraham Lincoln, without a doubt, was an extremely private person. And to this day, we still know very little about Abraham Lincoln. There's a lot of been written, but we still really don't know that much about him.
Well, we didn't have the 24-hour news cycle when Honest Abe was in office. And we don't know as much about Thomas Jefferson. We have a lot of speculation about both of their personal lives, but for the most part, it's just speculation, although I think there's more compelling evidence about Sally Hemings and Tom Jefferson, not the third president. And Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president. But, Mark, we didn't have TV cameras and radio microphones. We had newspapers, and it took days for people to find out what was going on in those days. It was a much different world than the one we're in now.
Well, they were shocked, though, because of the telegraph all of a sudden became a major factor, so that news got out a lot faster than what they were used to in those times. But I wanted to point out that that there has been more written about Abraham Lincoln. While the caller is right, we don't know much about his personal thoughts. We know more about Jefferson because Jefferson wrote his personal thoughts to John Adams.
Okay. 877-217-5757. Back with Mark after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number in the last quarter hour with Mark Ballard, who's at the nation's capital, is 877-217-5757. Doug on Highland. Doug, you're on the air with Mark. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, gentlemen. I felt compelled to make a point about the CNN issue that I think is being overlooked. Donald Trump attempted a violent overthrow of a free and fair election and the U.S. government with his followers, and they've made it clear they will do so again. And so CNN helped normalize that by giving him free time, prime time, air time. And either the new CEO of CNN supports the overthrow of the U.S. government, or he's so greedy and stupid that he doesn't care, or both. But it's something that shouldn't be normalized.
All right. I respect your point of view, Doug, but I do think that sunshine is the best prescription for discerning an opinion about somebody, and Donald Trump is somebody who could be president again, and I do think that he gained very few new supporters from that appearance. There were a lot of revelations by the way he conducted the event and by the answers he gave or did not give. And so in that respect, I think CNN did a public service. But I understand exactly what you're saying. He did get free airtime. But Mark, I would think most people have made their minds up about Donald Trump. Some people like him and some people don't. And we live in a state in which most people do like him, and you live in a city where 90% of the people can't stand the man. And this shows the division we have in our country right now.
Yeah, I believe that's exactly true. And you know, I tend to agree with you on this, though I understand his point, and you know, and I do clearly understand his point. But we're in a situation where there is a polarization in politics in a way that doesn't allow too much across the aisle, if you will, banter or negotiation or even chat. So.
James and Metairie. Hello, James. You're on the air.
Jim and Mark. It looks like Senator Kennedy's updated his comedy act. He didn't mention gas station sushi or drinking weed killer. However, RFK Jr. has distanced himself from Senator Kennedy. I hope I'm not repeating myself, saying that neither he or the senator are neither allied nor related. But this is alarming. One of the things that Kennedy has said in the past as to how to solve the drug problem, he suggested that the United States invade Mexico to subdue the drug cartels, which would probably initiate another war on our southern border.
Well,
thank you, Jim.
All right, James. By the way, RFK Jr. is opposing one Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. and has no chance of getting the Democratic nomination for president, but he is Bobby Kennedy's son. He does have the name, and he is a guy, despite some, I would say, out-of-the-mainstream beliefs. He's no dummy either. In tip-top physical condition, he does have spasmodic dysphonia, so that impedes his communication skills a bit, but there are rumors, Dan Moldea was telling me the other day, that there are rumors that Bobby Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy, and Donald Trump might end up on the same ticket together. Wouldn't that be something? Can you imagine those two together?
No, I can't. but you know, yeah, I guess that would be a possibility. And actually, I believe it. Well, I don't know if Robert Kennedy said it as well, but the comments came from the Mexican ambassador in his letter to asking for an apology from Senator Kennedy, saying that many in Mexico kind of got mixed up between who this John Kennedy was and John F. Kennedy, and that had to be set free. He said mm-hmm. that he had done his best to explain that they're totally different people. So.
Do you recall when Kennedy's former boss, Buddy Romer, insulted the Japanese consul who came to visit him, and he put his cowboy boots up on his desk and was yawning as the man was talking? That didn't sit well with the people of Mexico, of Japan, did it?
Of Japan, yeah. But it's a little bit different, though. I mean, you know,
Yeah, this was an outrageous assault on the country of Mexico. And a listener notes, and I'm hesitant to mention this considering President Carter's about to die, he's in hospice care, but once he stupidly, when he was president of the United States, went down to Mexico and made a comment about Montezuma's revenge. That didn't sit well with the people of Mexico either, and you can understand why. Henry, go ahead, Mark.
No, indeed, but it is not at the same
No.
League, you know,
no. And Kennedy knew exactly what he was saying, and my guess is that he will not apologize. Henry at the Country Club, good to hear from you. It's been a little while, but Henry, welcome back to Talk Louisiana.
Hello, Mr. Mark. Hello, Mr. Jim. Mr. Mark, since you've shared with us that you no longer live in Louisiana, that you're apparently a voting resident up there in Virginia, and that you can tell that it's not Louisiana, looking down here at us, what does it say for Louisiana when the two most unbeatable politicians we have are some guy that you can't tell the difference between him and Foghorn Leghorn, and a thug cop that got fired for not respecting the constitutional rights of folks?
All right. I think...
I'm not altogether sure that Clay Higgins is that popular outside of his district. And even in his district, there's a lot of at least mainstream Republicans that oppose him. Mm-hmm. So not enough to actually win. And I want to point out that I've moved up here, but not totally. I just sold the house, and so I'm still a registered voter in Louisiana. And that my family had lived there, you know, for 300 years, and I still have plenty of family in Louisiana, so I still kind of consider it home.
Now, Robin Dow has pulled a clip that I think is symbolic of yesterday's appearance on his monthly show. John Bel Edwards asked the governor, lamented how the Louisiana legislature is conducting business in a fiscal session. Here's how the governor sounded off on this matter.
You know, I really wish that our legislature would focus on things that grow the economy, get people employed, fix our infrastructure, address our critical needs, you know, homeowners insurance and other things. And rather than doing that, sometimes they just feel obligated to introduce bills into the legislature here that follow some sort of a national playbook. I don't believe we have any issues of the type that are at issue in that bill that need to be addressed here in Louisiana. I think it's unfortunate. And then, of course, you just got to wait and see how it might be amended and so forth. If it comes to my desk, you know, what it actually says at that particular point in time. But I think it's unfortunate. I really do. You know, so, for example, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided that there was a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry, are teachers going to be able to cover that? Are teachers going to be scared to cover it? Because they might get in trouble, they might lose their job. It's history. It's factual. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be able to cover it? It probably causes many more problems than it solves, because it solves exactly none.
John Bel Edwards talking about the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. And it is an election year, and these conservative lawmakers are more than willing to wade into these sensitive issues, and I'm sure it's because some consultant is saying, this is a winner. This is a winner, Mark.
Well, there's also a national movement that legislatures with Republican supermajorities in particular, but Republican majorities press these particular issues. There is an organization behind what they're doing. I don't know how tight the organization is, you know, but certainly the information they're getting from a national level is to push these kinds of issues.
All right. We're going to try to take at least one, maybe two calls. Ray in Prairieville. Do we have Ray ready? No. Okay. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. You know, Senator John Crocodile Tears Kennedy is basically expressing the domestic and foreign policy of his party, and he is expressing it very well. Thank you.
Well,
thank you, Mark, so much.
Well, John Kennedy was a Democrat in the year of 2004 when he finished a distant third in the race for U.S. Senate behind David Vitter and Chris John. And then 4 years later, he ran as a Republican. And in an election on the same ballot as John McCain, who got 60% of the votes, John Kennedy lost to Mary Landrieu by 5%. Landrieu cleaned his clock, and then he decided that moderate Republican wasn't working, so he went far right. And as his former political consultant, Roy Fletcher, said, Mark, John Kennedy learned how to read a poll. And he learned from his mistakes. He learned from his mistakes. I guess the question is this the real John Kennedy, or was the old John Kennedy the real John Kennedy? There is obviously a huge difference between the two.
I can't answer that question, though I tend to agree with Mr. Fletcher that he did learn how to read a poll. And the caller is right in one way, is that Senator Kennedy, at the beginning of all of those comments, began by saying that this is the way the American people see this, you know, rather than that this is the way that he personally sees it. It gets covered up because it was a quick thing, but he does kind of put.
Thank you, Mark. We'll talk next week. Signature support for First Financial Tax Accounting Services. Stay safe. Stay tuned.